Blog Talk Radio.
Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. Writing the biography of a well-known person in pop culture is an assignment fraught with trapdoors, two-way mirrors, and shackles. Some writers even disdain their subjects. Others hopelessly suck up to the person, if living, in the hopes of winning their favor. Journalists working in this genre, however, are usually after something more. They took on the life of an individual because they believe, through professional research and interviews, that they can add more color or depth to what's known about the figure's public and private lives. Today's Mr. Media guest, Larry Ratso Sloman, has trod the path of biography and ghostwritten autobiography a number of times in his career. He wrote Steal This Dream about the life of 60s dissident Abbie Hoffman. He helped Howard Stern pen his life story in two memorable books, Private Parts and Miss America. When Anthony Kiedis of the Red Hot Chili Peppers needed someone to help tell his story, Kiedis turned to Sloman. The book many people remember Sloman best for, however, may well be his chronicle of Bob Dylan's remarkable 1975 Rolling Thunder Review concert tour, On the Road with Bob Dylan. That is also where he earned his unusual nickname, which I'm told he wears with pride, like a badge of courage. Sloman's latest book, written with William Kalish, is Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero. Larry, welcome to Mr. Media.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Larry, Houdini is a fast read, thanks to the focus on storytelling and the wealth of incredible detail that you and your partner uncovered about the magician and the man. Can you tell us a little bit about how the book came about and the style in which it's written?
Right. Well, it's interesting because I first got interested in magic when I co-authored or ghostwrote. I don't always know what to say, but with David Blaine, he was writing his memoir, Mysterious Stranger, and so I worked with David. And one of the first things, it was a hybrid book. That book was, part reminiscent about his various stunts of being encased in ice and being buried underground. It was also part teaching you how to do some magical effects. And it was also a kind of history of magic. And for the history part, David said, well, you have to go work with Kalush, because he produced all my shows, and he's got the most amazing magic library in the world. So we went spent a lot of time at Kalush's library. It's called the Conjuring Arts Research Center. Did all this research, and we did a chapter on Houdini in the David Blaine book. So that was my first exposure to reading about Houdini. I read all the extant biographies of Houdini at the time. And I remember sitting around with Kalush and saying, you know, it's really strange. I mean, there's all these gaps in Houdini's story, and he makes strange career choices. I think there's more to this than meets the eye. And Kalush says, yeah, I agree. And the more we looked into it, the more we've said, you know, there really, I think, is time to take a fresh look at Houdini. And that's the genesis of The Secret Life of Houdini.
And what about the storytelling? What I really like about the book is that every page is almost a separate anecdote in some ways, in that you're always storytelling. You're not just saying, well, you know, when he did this. And it's not so much analysis, which some people expect in biography, but it's storytelling, which is what I expect.
Right.
And I really like that.
Well, it sounds funny, but we kind of wanted to write this book almost... Well, is that going to be a problem?
It's okay. I can pause.
Okay, somebody's... There's probably some worthless facts. I could start again if it's... let's get... Okay. It's funny the way we wrote this book. I it's in a way we almost wanted to do a celebrity biography of Houdini, akin to the ones I had written with Howard Stern and people like that. We wanted it to be accessible. We wanted it to be anecdote driven. I mean, there was a professor at NYU, Silverman, had done an exhaustive biography, which kind of, you know, laid out you know, a lot of the facts, but it really didn't. The story wasn't driven by these anecdotes, and to us, I mean, that seemed the best way to capture Houdini. And you know, I mean, he's such an incredibly complex guy.
And you did a tremendous amount of research in terms of organizing stuff that was arcane and seemingly unconnected.
Well, thanks to what we lovingly called Ask Alexander. It was based on Ask Alexander. It was based on Alexander the Mentalist. And what we did is we created a huge, huge database. We scanned in every known Houdini book, all the magazines, magic magazines that Houdini, that Kalush had in his collection. We scanned in all the letters. We scanned in all the scrapbooks and made them text searchable. So, I mean, that the book could have taken 25 years to write if we weren't able to really have that instant access. Because, you know, this research project, you know, was over 2 years. So, you know, at the beginning of research, you may come across a name. A year and a half later, you may come across that name again and say, wow, didn't I think, does this guy have something maybe, you know? Well, we just put the name into the database, and boom, in 5 seconds, we had every hit on that name. So it was just a tremendous expedient. I think it's really the first, you know, Houdini biography of the digital age that, you know, and that's what we were able to, you know, kind of collate all this, you know, incredibly diverse material.
Now, a lot of writers, and Doris Kearns Goodwin comes to mind, has been in trouble the last couple of years with issues of plagiarism. I'm not saying that you did this, but my question is, when you scan in material like that, how do you avoid that? I mean, like Doris's comment was, well, it was inadvertent that I used material from another source, but you know, when you go to this digital type of system and you scan in all this stuff, it would seem like the situation is ripe for that kind
of... Well, I mean, you know, you have to know, and basically, you know, if we, the book is full of citations. I mean, we, you know, we use very liberally use Houdini's own writings.
Mm-hmm.
We use letters that he'd written. So it, you know, it's, I don't think the problem so much is plagiarizing anything, because you know, the analysis that we did was almost separate from the writing process. I mean, you know, we kind of overlaid the analysis onto the writing.
Nice.
And the analysis was, you know, basically between me and Kalush, who was the magic expert. So, you know, if there was a question of, you know, how Houdini did something, and we wanted to reveal that. And a lot of times we didn't reveal that, obviously. But there were times where we did reveal some of his methods, and that was kind of overlaid after the kind of main narrative had been written already.
Will the way that you use technology to research this biography affect the way you do it in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no other way to do it. You know, it's just like it's so overwhelming to have that amount of material. But you know, when you have it in a way that's manageable, and that you know, literally you could do searches in microseconds, and you know, it's not just our database, but we also used you know, all the major newspaper now you know, have their entire archives, you know, and database. We were able to find out a lot about Wilkie, who was the head of the Secret Service, who nobody really knew anything about, but we were able to find out his connections to the world of magic through some of this, you know, an article in the Washington Post, you know, in 1908. because of this new technology. So it's certainly, you know, an incredible boon. I mean, I'm sure we would never been able to find those articles if not for that.
I think one of the most controversial revelations in the book is Houdini as spy.
Well, you know, it's funny. Yeah, it was controversial at first. And then when, you know, and the magic world is very insular, so... you know, a lot of these guys are saying, well, we don't know about this, so therefore it can't be true. But, you know, when you get a guy like the former head of the CIA, John McLaughlin, who reads the book and says, yeah, I'll write that introduction to your book, and says in the introduction, yeah, this is absolutely plausible to me. So, you know, I don't think you can have anybody better vouching for your theory than the former head of the CIA.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's a great read. I hope it's doing well, and I hope more people will read it.
Well, it's doing well, and in fact, the latest wave of, you know, unbelievable press and attention has been the whole exhumation thing, and that was based on our research, and it, you know, it was one of these serendipitous things. I mean, 2 years ago, I attended the annual Houdini seance that Sid Radner, a Houdini scholar and collector, puts on every year. And that year it was in Las Vegas, because he was also auctioning off a lot of Houdini material. And at the seance, there was the great-granddaughter of Marjorie, the world's most famous medium at the time, who was Houdini's adversary in the last years of his life. So I approached her. It turns out she lives in Long Island, not too far from where I have a weekend place. So I said, could I come and interview you? So figuring that there may be some great family anecdotes about Marjorie and Houdini. And she said, sure. And I go to visit her and her husband, and they make me a nice dinner, and we have a great interview. And at the end of the interview, I said, now, you wouldn't happen to have, like, some letters or, you know, any kind of documents laying around? She said, oh, yeah, come on. And she takes me into a spare bedroom, and she opens up the closet door, and it's filled with, the entire closet is filled with boxes and boxes of correspondence, including correspondence with Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Oliver Lodge, all the leading luminaries of the spiritualist movement. It's got over 30 scrapbooks of Marjorie that were amassed by her husband. And that was, nobody had seen this material for 80 years. Except for her and her mother. And it was, my jaw dropped. And I wound up spending the next 2 weeks over there every day. She was such a doll, she even helped me carry the material to the local store to Xerox it. And those thousands of pages were then put into the Alexander, made text searchable. And from that material, we developed the most compelling part of the book to me, which was the last few years of his life and how the battle with the spiritualists may have ended with Houdini's death at their hands. I mean, now, you know, we don't say for sure that, you know, we definitely think he was murdered, but we raise enough issues about it and, that the Houdini's grandnephew read the book and said, you know, hey, I want to get to the bottom of this, and it means we'd have to exhume his body and test for poisoning. And in fact, we worked with, while we were writing the book and talking about the last few years of his life and the medical problems at the end, we had consulted Dr. Michael Bodden, who's one of the great forensic pathologists in the country, in the world. And Bodden then called a friend of his, a colleague, Professor James Stars at George Washington University, who's a dual professor in law and forensics. This is a guy who's, you know, when... you know, in cases where it is to solve a murder mystery or things like that, he has exhumed some of the most very famous people. He read the book. I sent him the book on Bond's recommendation. He read the book, and he said, you guys have really raised enough issues that, you know, sign me up. I want to get involved in this. And he has amassed an amazing team of forensic scientists, two anthropologists, two toxicologists, two of everything, because he's very thorough, two pathologists, including Dr. Michael Bodden. So the team is all set, and now it's just a matter of going through the legal motions, but it's, you know, tremendously gratifying to us that, you know, that the research that we came up with could lead to, you know, the world's leading forensic scientist saying, yeah, I think you guys really have something here. Let's look into it.
Well, it's one thing to collect history, but then to suddenly find yourself affecting history has got to be very rewarding.
Yeah, and, you know, people say to me, well, you know, what difference does it make? It was 80 years ago. Whoever killed him, if they did kill him, is long gone. Well, you know, what difference does it make? Well, you know, I think it makes tremendous difference because, you know, if Houdini died fighting the spiritualists, who in his mind at that time were public enemy number one because they were preying on the most vulnerable people in society, people who had recently lost loved ones and were desiring to get in touch with them. And these people were, you know, manipulating and conning and bilking these people out of tremendous amounts of money. And if Houdini wound up being murdered by them, then he died a hero's death. He's, you know, not just, you know, one of the world's greatest entertainers, but his life assumes heroic proportions.
Now, I want to ask you one more thing about Houdini, and then there's some other things I want to talk about. Okay. I suspect that what a lot of people know about Houdini comes from the movies.
Right.
Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh for the old school gang, or Paul Michael Glaser and Sally Struthers for my generation. I wondered if you had a preference now among the portrayals.
Excuse me?
I wondered if you had a preference among the portrayals of Houdini.
Well, I don't think any of them has really captured Houdini. In fact, the worst was the Tony Curtis film, because that's got to be like the most passive-aggressive example of how Hollywood could defame a legend, because, you know, they have Houdini dying in one of the devices of his own making. And, you know, one thing we know about Houdini, I mean, Houdini became a Superman to people because he could never be constrained. That was his whole shtick. And every night he would be tested, he would be challenged. It was whether it was handcuffs or leg cuffs or put in a box or, put in a safe or, you know, inside a giant football or inside a big whale. I mean, no matter what it was, he got out. And, you know, to have Hollywood killing him in his own water torture cell is just the worst.
Now, has your book been optioned for TV or movie at this point?
Well, there's talk going on right now, so knock on wood. We'll see what happens.
Well, good luck with that. Let's talk about some of your work as a collaborator or a ghostwriter. And I know from my own experience, because I do a lot of that work, you never know from book to book if you're going to be thought of as a ghostwriter or a collaborator.
Right.
Even if your name is on the book, some people still call you a ghostwriter.
Right.
You work with Howard Stern on both of his books. How did that job come about?
Well, it's interesting because that was the beginning of my kind of second career, because I've been writing my own books for years. I had done that Dylan book, which you talked about, On the Road, Bob Dylan. And while I was editing, I edited High Times magazine and then National Lampoon magazine for a number of years. And while I was doing the editing, I had written a book called Reefer Madness, History of Marijuana in America. And then I did a book on the New York Rangers, because I play hockey twice a week, even till today. So I had a kind of an eclectic nonfiction background, but I was working. I had kind of portrayed myself in a movie that a friend of mine shot in Luxembourg, and the director was friendly with Stern's agent, Don Buchwald. Buchwald had clients, and he was always trying to get in this director's films. And I had heard Howard talking about doing, writing a book on the air. And I said, wow, that sounds like fun. I wouldn't mind doing that. So my friend, the director, called Buchwald, and Buchwald said, Ratso, that sounds like a perfect match for Howard. And I met first with Judith Regan, because she was the editor of the book, Simon & Schuster. And we had a nice meeting, and then we set up a meeting between me and Judith and Howard and Buchwald. And I remember the night before the meeting, I'm saying, should I come up with something for this meeting? I mean, is it just the meet and greet? You know what? And I figured, I'll come up with an idea. And I remember going to the meeting, we were talking about what the book might be like. And I said, you know, Howard is very famous for his, you know, on-air ad-libbed ads, where he'll, you know, do like a whole minute or 2 minutes and just riff for one of his sponsors, Snapple or whoever it is. I said, so why don't we have each chapter sponsored by a different And they loved that idea. Howard couldn't believe it. That's fantastic. I mean, ultimately they never did it, but that would have been just so great to have interrupt each chapter with Howard doing an ad.
Oh, my God.
So that's how that came about.
Yeah, I have that in front of me. It was just a fun read. It was unlike any autobiography I think I'd ever read.
Right. Well, see, again, there, talk about being a ghostwriter. I became the most famous ghostwriter in history because, you know, my name's not on the front cover.
Right.
But
your picture's in there.
Of course, in the lead acknowledgement. But more than that, Howard had, you know, 5-6 hours every morning to fill up on the air. So what does he talk about? He talks about his life. So he talks about working with Ratso. So I became this, you know, such a celebrated ghostwriter because he was talking about it every day on the air. And, you know, he was so shrewd, and so, he's such a, you know, a master of publicity, like B.T. Barnum. You know, Howard had worked up his audience for literally for months and months and months before the release of the book. And I'll never forget when the book finally came out, and on that day, right after the show, we were going to go over to Barnes & Noble's on Fifth Avenue and have an autograph signing. And just Howard's, you know, rallying the troops and come out to see us on Fifth Avenue. So the show's over, and I go in the limo with Howard to drive over there. And we're driving down one of the side streets, and we can't even get close to Fifth Avenue. We figure there's been some accident, or got shot, or what, you know. And Ronnie, the limo driver, says, "You better get out here because I can't even get close to Fifth Avenue." We get out, and we see Fifth Avenue has been closed down because 35,000 people in front of Barnes & Noble. I mean, it was like, I felt like Murray Takei, like the fifth Beatle. One of the greatest experiences of my life.
Oh, my God. And I'm guessing that the store did not have that many copies of the book on hand.
They were reaching out to every other store in the area. I know Howard wound up staying there till 6 in the afternoon.
Wow.
And he signed every book. So it was just, you know, phenomenal.
That book was quite a story. And when you have that kind of outlet to promote something, and of course the movie then followed and the same reaction.
Right. And he was a joy to work with. You know, Howard was, you know, he makes what he does look so easy. Mm. But I know how much preparation goes into his radio show. I mean, the guy was just a tremendous Jewish workaholic, and so it was like two Jewish workaholics in the same room. We would, like, you know, I'd go out to his house after the, you know, he got off the air, so we'd get out there maybe, you know, around 11 o'clock, and we'd start working, and sometimes it would be like 7 o'clock at night, and Howard would look at me and says, "Are you hungry? You want to keep going?" And I'd say, "All right, let's eat something." And he was always into, you know, these weird diets, and he was measuring out how many almonds he could have, and you know, he would put out food like, you know, salads, and I would say, "Howard, feed me. I got to eat." But we had a great time doing it.
Now, you were around on his last day on terrestrial radio, so
right.
you've obviously maintained that relationship.
Yeah.
Will he ever write another book?
Well, yeah, actually, it's funny because one of the last times I saw him a couple of weeks ago, he had talked to me. He said, "You know, I really want to write another book, and I don't think now is the right time, but when it is, I'm going to have a lot to say." I'm sure we can look forward to that.
Now, let me ask you this. As you look back on all the biographies and the ghostwritten autobiographies, the collaborations that you've done, is there any book that you wish you hadn't written? And I'm wondering this because of one particular title, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, Thin Ice, The Season in Hell with the New York Rangers.
Well, no, I mean, that was just, you know, kind of, you know, taking a literary reference and, you know, putting Rambo into a book about hockey. But, no, that was actually a terrifically enjoyable book to do. And,
okay.
You know, I mean, I love hockey. In fact, I'm, you know, going to every one of the Ranger playoffs games, you know, starting this week. I went last week. It turned out not to be the greatest season because, you know, they didn't do well that season. But I had tremendous access to the guys. And it was very fulfilling to write the book and to be recognized. There's a book out, I think, called The Five Best of Hockey or whatever, and they have, you know, like the five best slap shots, the five best whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the five best books ever written about hockey, and they included Thin Ice, which was gratifying to me. So if anything, I would, to answer your question, I would say I don't wish I didn't write it, but probably the most tedious experience was the Abbie Hoffman book.
Really?
And that's because it was don't get me wrong, I mean, Abbie was a hero to me. I mean, growing up, he was the kind of Jewish warrior role model for me, and I was, very young and, escaping Queens to go to the East Village for the Summer of Love. And the first time I met Abbie, I was hanging out at the East Village Other, which was the underground newspaper in the East Village.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of wild guy comes in with a crazy electric hair, Jewish afro, and he says, come on, come with us, cover this. And we're going to the stock market, and the yippies are throwing money onto the floor of the stock exchange. And we're one of the greatest guerrilla actions of all time. So, I mean, it was a... I loved hanging out with Abbie, and, we remained friendly over the years, and my friend Kinky Friedman even harbored Abbie when he went underground, and he stayed at Kinky's Ranch in Texas. But doing the book was unpleasant, and one of the reasons was because I did the oral biography form, which means it's just, and I tried to make it as seamless as possible, just going from interview to interview without any kind of narrative thread.
It's a challenge.
It wound up taking about 9 years to do because, people's agendas aren't yours, so you always have to be tracking down. And then you always have to track down this person, and this person lead to 10 more people. And then if you're a completist, I got to interview 100 more people, and so it just never ends. And also there was all this kind of animosity going on, and you could see why the left never succeeded in anything, because they're always devouring themselves, they're always fighting over turf, and it was like, how could you write this book about Abbie, because his wife is writing a book, and his brother's writing, it was just insanity, the whole thing.
Well, we before we run out of time, we have to talk about Bob Dylan, of course. What is your fondest memory of the Rolling Thunder Review?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint one memory because, basically it was Dylan going back to his roots, surrounding himself so that the burden of superstardom wasn't just on him, but, making it into like an old-timey review and having Rambling Jack Elliott with him and Joan Baez. And then in every town we went to, whoever was in town, whether it was in Toronto, Gordon Lightfoot, Montreal, Leonard Cohen, in Connecticut, Joni Mitchell showed up. She wound up staying for the next 3 weeks. I mean, it was just a magical kind of caravan of just, wonderful creative people. And I think the greatest thing on the tour was when I had a fight with, I was covering for Rolling Stone magazine. And then I had a fight with my editors there because they were, interested in how much a tour was grossing, and they were interested in, that kind of stuff. And I was much more interested in describing this cultural phenomenon. So I wound up quitting Rolling Stone in the middle and leaving the rental car in Vermont somewhere and just staying on with the tour. And I had asked Dylan, I said, look, this has to be documented. Let me write my song. And he did, and he let me stay on the tour, and I really documented everything.
As you were describing that, I just remembered something from when I was a teen. I was, I guess, about 14 or 15 when that tour was going on, and I remember being in the family station wagon driving through upstate New York on the way to Connecticut and hearing on the radio that this tour was going to happen. And it was the first time I remember thinking, I'd really like to go to that.
it was an amazing thing because it was almost like a guerrilla tour because
yeah.
There wasn't really advertising. They would like go into a town, and it was all small little venues for the most part at the beginning of the tour. And they would go into a town, put up posters, and the Rolling Thunder Review, and it was very mysterious, and the tickets would immediately sell out. And to see him at the height of his creative powers, because, I wrote the liner notes to the Sony Records reissue of the tapes from that tour. a 2-CD set. And if you listen to that, I mean, he's, in my estimation, never been greater. I mean, so much energy every night, and, you know, so inspired by all the artists around him. And, you know, also had trying to get Hurricane Carter out of jail, and so you had the whole social consciousness. And, you know, it just was an amazing, amazing tour.
What's your relationship with Dylan today? Is that, have you maintained that as well?
Yeah, we, after the tour, a few years later, George Lowe was a famous advertising guy, and I produced a video for Bob called Joker Man that was on the Infidels album.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we stay in touch, and I see him whenever, you know, he told me in that book that touring is in his blood, and he's basically a nomad, and that's absolutely been true. He's on the road, you know, 200 dates out of every year. So whenever he comes to New York, you know, I go see the show and go backstage, and you know, he's a tremendous inspiration. I mean, just to keep going, and his last three albums have been amazing.
Mm.
So to have that kind of, you know, I don't like to use media terms like comeback, because, you know, he never went anywhere. You know, to have the attention focused on him again for, you know, his tremendous creativity and his contributions is very gratifying.
Now, the story I've heard about your nickname, Ratso,
right,
which I can't even, it pains me to even say it out loud, is that it came from Joan Baez, that
right.
She had called you Ratso, and you asked if it was because you reminded her of Dustin Hoffman,
right,
co-starred with John Voight in Midnight Cowboy, for the younger people who don't know what we're talking about. If that's correct so far, could you kind of finish the story from there?
Yeah, well, you know, it was during the tour, and you know how on a tour you get a little grubby and you don't shave, maybe you take some substance to stay up at night, you know. So I had a red Granada rental car, and I remember driving up to the hotel where they were staying, and they're playing volleyball outside, a few of the people, and Baez comes over the car and she goes, "Hey, look, it's Ratso." And like you said, I said, "Oh, you know, call me Ratso because I remind you of Dustin Hoffman." She says, "No, you remind me of Ratso Rizzo." And that stuck. And when she called me Ratso, I turned the book around from first person to third person. So then Ratso became this character that was, you know, kind of under the microscope for the rest of the book. And it was an interesting trip because, you know, Dylan had invited me on the tour, and then he had this layer of management and road managers whose job was to keep the press away from him. And it was funny because I knew all the people in his band. I hung out in that scene. Phil Oakes at the time was my roommate because I had moved into his apartment and he had nowhere to go, so we let him stay in the apartment. So so Dylan was very gracious and very forthcoming and very cordial to me, yet the managers were always trying to kick me out. And they would even tamper with my car at times, and it became a big joke. So Ratso became this kind of, you know, character who had to surmount all the odds to get his story.
And you've embraced that over time. I mean, emails from you come with that in the name. I mean, you could have let that go at any time, but you've actually, am I wrong?
I guess I could have, but, you know, well, you know, Sam Shepard wrote a book about the same tour.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam Shepard was hired to write the screenplay for Ronaldo and Clara, the movie that Bob was doing while they were touring. And it wound up that didn't work out. And so I guess he felt he had spent so much time on the road, he may as well do something. So he put his journal together into the Rolling Thunder logbook. And he wrote a couple of chapters about me in that book. And at one point, he called me the supreme master of tack and bad taste. And it was a compliment. I mean, he referred me, you know, he compared me to some of the, you know, kind of avant-garde artists that he knew from East Village. So I guess, you know, I took pride in being that, and Ratso was as good a name as any.
Well, on that note, Larry Ratso,
right,
thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media this week.
It was a pleasure, Bob.
Folks, if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe to the audio feed in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for joining us. Please come back next week for another Fridays with Mr. Media.